Yeah, I'd rather be much we can move into the next session and adopt the 2 days before Honorable Harris comes back. No, no, his jacket is here. Yeah. You come to a meeting and give an apology. We consider your apology to be present. Where's your colleague on the road? You're not your brother's keeper. Okay, but I think we can start in the meantime. The first piece of legislation that we're dealing with, or the bill, is the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, and then to be followed by the Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill. If one was just to recap quickly on the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, this draft was released by National Treasury for comment on the 28th of June this year. First presented to the committee on the 2nd of August, and we held public hearings on the 22nd of August. And we had a report back of National Treasury on the 11th of September. And the bill was formally referred to us on the 25th of October. So it is not a new set of issues that we are dealing with completely. And I thought I should just give this background and get a direction from the committee. If there's anything that you still want to further deliberate on this particular piece of legislation or bill. No comment? Let's get, if you seem to be surprised. So Tim, your colleagues or colleagues in the Standing Committee of Finance will brief you of what we've just done. We've adopted the two pieces of legislation in your absence, very much, and it was liberating. We are hoping you have a second. Yeah. I'm just giving the background of the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, where we come from. And we seem to be concurring as a committee that there's no further comments that we need to make on this particular piece of legislation. And therefore, the report needs to be tabled. And if there's any comment that you want to make on the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, Tim?
I have some civil proposals for the Tax Admin Bill.
That's the Tax Administration. Okay. Now I deal with the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill.
TLAB first.
Do you agree? Okay, agreed. Let me read. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, B34/2012, National Assembly Section 77, referred to it and classified by the JTM as money bill, report that it has agreed to the bill. Agreed? Agreed. Assigning. Now, we are now moving to the second bill. Taxation Laws Amendment, what is that? Yeah, Tax Administration Law Amendment Bill. Any comment on this one? Remember, I was very generous in the last set, and we've made it here. Tim?
So I, as I indicated yesterday with Mr. Tomasek, I don't think it is the right approach to defer the consideration of the issue of privilege for tax practitioners so after an 18-month period when we then review the current framework. I agree with the presenters that came before us and said that they to see this, this undertaken now to include some form of statutory protection. I think there's merit in their request, and I think we should draft an amendment to the tax amendment bill to include that now, rather than waiting 18 months.
Chairperson, I am totally against it. I think it is highly inappropriate even to consider it at this time. It's a highly contentious issue in the legal fraternity, not only in this country, coming from a Roman Dutch background, but even in other countries where they do not even come from a Roman Dutch legal background. So it will be highly inappropriate to even consider doing that without a full report or investigation or the legal, best legal range in front of us, giving us a legal opinion on that. I should suggest that to the tax advising industry, get a good lawyer's opinion before you come again and ask for this.
Not unless we are told as to what are the envisaged implications of not doing it, because from where I am, I think as correctly cited by Honorable Koranov, and correctly cited by Sarah's presentation yesterday, there is obviously a wide range of stakeholders. Some of these, not stakeholders, in fact, some of these people who are advising on tax matters are not necessarily trained as tax people, but because of their long service in the field, I mean, they have been very happy in the industry. So it tells that there are a lot of dynamics that still need to be and out. Because, truly speaking, from where I am, it's not going to help for us to rush doing it now while we know that there are these gaps. And then in the near future, again, we are told that we have overlooked some of the critical aspects. I'm more comfortable with the suggestion as presented by SARS and supported by Honorable Corona. Thank you.
Dean?
Look, I acknowledge the degree of work required that the Honorable Cornos is referring to, but what I'm suggesting is that we must then undertake that work as legislators. I think I'm happy to convert my suggestion from a firm amendment to the bill before us now. If this committee takes on the project of investigating that as a piece of legislating that we should be looking into the pros and cons of, that we should be assessing. And I agree with Honorable Cornell, we need experts to advise us, but I think we shouldn't just simply leave this to Treasury. I think we should undertake this so that this committee can have a well-developed, reasoned position as to whether we should be including such protections in this bill next year. So I'm happy to defer my suggestion, as long as we do undertake this as a project of the committee, and we don't just simply leave it to the jury.
I don't think there's much difficulty with that. It's part of our responsibility to continue to research on pieces of legislation that we pass. I think I agree on that, Honourable Member. Okay. Let me then, therefore, get this. Any other? Tim?
Chair, I was sufficiently convinced by the concerns raised around Clause 15 and the penalties on the adequate estimates of second provisional tax payments. I have remaining concerns that haven't been addressed by Treasury, and I think in the light of those concerns, I think that we should consider leaving out the amendments and considering them carefully before next year, when we could perhaps include them. I am not sure that I'm satisfied with the reply on the concerns around Clause 15. So my proposal is that we leave that one, those amendments out for now.
Honourable Member? What are second 15? Honorable Gordon Wolf?
Can I just ask Honorable Harris just to be a little bit more specific? Of course, I think you can't just take out clause 15. Maybe there's one or two sections we must be can look at, but...
The point of the chair is that if you take out the amendments in clause 15, then the tax laws remain as they are, rather than being amended like this. So we're not leaving a black hole, we're just simply not amending. That would be my proposal. I mean, if I've missed any potential pitfalls from doing that in terms of perhaps the gaps in the current framework, then I'm open to those that insight. But as far as I see it, we can just simply not make amendments in clause 15 and revert back to the legislation as it currently stands.
Palata?
Thank you, Chair. It's clause 23 in the bill as introduced. There are several things happening in this clause. One is the 20% automatic 20% penalty, which I would just emphasize is historically where we come from. Where we are now is something that has only been in place for a few years. But there are other things happening here too. What is also happening here is an amendment to ensure that where your employee's tax and provisional tax meet your liability, even if your estimate is understated, you are not subject to the penalty. Because as it stands at the moment, you have the anomalous situation that if your estimate is wrong, but you've paid the right amount of tax, you're subject to the penalty. Now, SARS generally speaking waive the penalty because there's been no prejudice, but the question is why should we even be in the space of imposing a penalty in the first place? And that's one of the things the amendments here do. The amendment in B then goes on just to further align the provisions of the paragraph 20 to the Tax Administration Act. What is currently clause C, sub-clause C, then excludes the retirement fund lump sum benefits, retirement fund lump sum withdrawal benefits, and severance benefits from the provisional tax system because they are subject to their own separate schedule and therefore should not be part of the provisional tax system. And then what is currently sub-clause D is the one that changes the discretion of the commissioner to remit to ensure that it covers both subparagraph A and B in paragraph 1, items A and B in subparagraph 1 of paragraph 20. So there are three different things happen in this clause. The one is a pair of concessions, the other is the change to an automatic penalty, and then there's the related change to a discretion to remit the penalty if good grounds are given to the commissioner.
Okay. I accept that, and I don't have a problem with two of the three proposals there, so it would be far too broad a brush to simply take out this section. My problem is with the automatic imposition of the 20%. I'm just looking at the drafting now. Can I just check, because we seem to be looking at different versions. Is this the version, the final? Okay. I've made notes on a previous version, but I think you'll get where I'm going to. Perhaps we simply change the word must to the word may in 15A. Or even sort of go back to the previous formulation, which says may and then qualify that may. I guess the real problem is the automatic imposition of 20%, which I think several presenters flagged and which I have some sympathy for. So perhaps we could just not make that amendment under 15A.
Basically, that could be correct. If you were to strike the deletion and remove the insertion of must, that would probably do the trick. The question is whether you want to do that or not. Just the reasoning, as I've said previously, is simply twofold. One that puts the over million rand people in the same position as the under million rand people. And when we talk of an automatic penalty, we must remember it is only an automatic penalty if you're outside a 20% margin of error. So, and as I've also pointed out, it's a relatively small number of taxpayers we're dealing with here too.
You don't do much harm if you do it as must.
Yeah, from our perspective, what the may means is that essentially we have to treat all those taxpayers as exceptions to the rule, which applies to the, all the other taxpayers who are currently subject to the must. The question is, do you wish to give an exception to the over millions or not? And the proposal is that we should retain that exception for we should retain that exception for the over millions and sort of leave, not move them back into the sort of general.
Tim, we're not going to be long on this particular matter.
No, Chair, except that the Commissioner still has the ability to impose the 20%, simply about whether it's automatic or not. I don't see a problem with leaving it up to the discretion of the Commissioner.
The Commissioner.
Maybe I'm missing something, though, but it seems to me to be perfectly reasonable as it was before, and I'm not sure there's a justification for the automatic imposition of the 20%, that's all.
Can we pass this one? Do you have other amendments that you want factor? Let's just go through them. How many do you have? We'll pass this one and come back to it.
I've got three more.
Go through them.
The second one, Chair, is... Sorry.
Go to the red one. You don't have the second one.
I do have the second one. I think we should consider the suggestions in the public hearings that section, or clause 58 rather, which introduces 240A, that they were requesting that we specify that the qualifications and education requirements of tax practitioners is relevant to tax. And I think there's merit to those proposals. I didn't hear anybody else in the committee argue against including a focus on taxation. So my proposal would be if we accept the suggestion that 58, and the clause 58, that 240A2, you simply introduce a new clause that specifies that those items listed under 240A2A are within the field of taxation, in line with what the many submissions asked for. That's my second.
I think this one is much easier. Let's deal with it. Because you're talking about tax practitioners and the qualification thereof in that particular field. That should be specific. I'm not sure if there's any difference beyond that one. Yes?
Chair, as I flagged yesterday, you do run into the problem that if you say you have to have a minimum tax qualification, you have an issue with people who have relevant prior experience. And you have what we would call composite bodies, so you may have a body which only deals with tax, so it's then very easy for them to have a tax-specific set of continuing professional education requirements. But if you're dealing with a body that is, say, an accounting body or some other body, they may have both. So it becomes a little bit more difficult to tease out the tax aspects.
I think there is no relevant confusion. Other
The way it reads now, it says, if the body maintains relevant and effective, and then there's the list, minimum qualification and experience requirements, continuing professional education requirements, codes of ethics and conduct, and disciplinary codes and procedures. The point we were simply making yesterday was the relevant there must clearly be relevant in this space.
Okay. I think it's okay. I think it's okay. Relevant. Agreed? Can you move the third one, Tim?
No, I mean, I disagree. Obviously, I wouldn't have proposed it if I didn't think so. So I would like to raise up my objection then.
That's fine.
Okay. The third one is, it's simply a general point. It's not, I don't have a firm proposal. But I have sympathy with the view of the presenters who told us that the regulation should also apply to SAR officials. I haven't formulated a proposal, but I think it's something which we would think should be added to the bill. There's no reason why we should seek to regulate health practitioners in this way, but not apply the same requirements to SARS officials. So that's, maybe it's something which the state law advisor could help me formulate, but I haven't drafted a firm proposal. It's just a principle which I'd like to see adopted and which isn't.
Chair, you must remember what we're dealing with here is essentially consumer protection, and we're ensuring that consumers are in a position to have an avenue to address the issues that they have with practitioners. Now, you may argue that consumers may equally have a problem with SARS. We accept that, but there are a number of mechanisms to resolve those issues that you may have with SARS, amongst them the tax ombud, which is coming into force shortly. And I would add, as SARS is certainly not concerned about having this extra layer of oversight. After all, we were proposing it in the draft legislation that was circulated for public comment in the Tax Administration Bill last year. And in fact, one of the changes that you will see between the draft that was issued earlier this year and the bill as introduced is in Clause 2, where the mandate of the tax ombud is extended to customs and excise matters as well. So we would respectfully submit that there are a number of existing channels and prospective channels that are available if you have an issue with SARS and its officials.
Tim? Okay.
No, I disagree.
That's fine. But I think if you listen to what SARS say, Mr. Thomas says, the intention here is to regulate the relationship between the tax practitioner and the client, in this instance the consumer. We are then saying, over and above that, in the regulation we should find a way to regulate the activities of staff officials. That's what we're saying.
Right. I'm saying if you're asking for a minimum standard in terms of qualifications and service levels, then the same minimum standard should apply, and I think that could apply very neatly to SARS officials too. That's all.
Chairperson, can I ask a question maybe to Africa Jenkins? When you're dealing with the state attorney or the national prosecuting authority, are they members of the site bar and bar, and are they being regulated by those associations? Because that will be an example, you know, if that is the case, then we might just ask to look at this or might come back next year with a firm proposal with regard to this.
Thank you, Chair.
There are two advocates, by the way, you and Honorable Gwen.
He's under the sidebar.
Oh,
I would be under the bar if I was at the court.
Okay.
From the advocate point of view, not my advocate, but the advocate profession point of view, my case specifically, I can talk of course without a doubt, I cannot be a member of the bar while I work for government because you lose your independence. So it is really about who is supervising you. My supervision is done by my chief law advisor, acting or the deputy secretary in the secretary of parliament. We're also governed by principles of public administration and that's the 10 of the constitution, etc. When you fall outside that private practice, then you go sidebar, bar. There are members
of the type are working for government who will keep their registration open, keep on paying their trust fees. But whether they're subject to the discipline of the SAIPAR, I doubt. I mean, they will be much more subject to the Public Service Commission or their relevant employment, the Department of Employment, whichever department employs them. So I would, from that point of view, what the bill is trying to do, and from the submissions I've heard, it's two different things. One is about regulation of relationships within the private sector around tax matters. That's my view, Chairperson. The other point where they say, well, this is what SARS should have, that's an HR issue for government. You know, do you have the best people working for you? Are they adequately qualified? Do they have the necessary experience? And I want to say, if we found, if the public finds the government is lacking in skills and expertise, they should address that with government. The government can pass a law. We can pass a law to say this is what public officials must have in terms of qualification or experience. But it's not there at the moment. And it is, for me, a separate issue. It's an employment issue of government service rather than a tax issue, a tax administration issue. Thanks, sir.
Honourable Koronov, are you fine? Conrad?
Yeah, no, Chair, I think listening to this explanation correctly put in terms of legal jargon, I'm convinced that if we are to take this route, it's like saying SARS has employed the wrong people, or we are like interrogating, I mean, HR process of SARS to say what the wrong people to do the job. So could we start the review? I mean, if we have the right people to do the job.
Thank you.
So I'm comfortable.
No,
I don't even think we have the power to do that.
Okay, Tawase?
Yeah, I think that was an excellent summary that we've really had. Thank you.
I disagree on this one as well, and I'll just tell you why very quickly. It's because this is actually quite light touch regulation, as Treasury really goes out of their way to remind us. It's really just saying you need to have these qualifications and you need to belong to these groupings. I really don't think that that's too much to ask from SARS officials. I would support that this includes them as well. That remains my position despite the arguments to the contrary.
Yeah. I think I hear what they're saying, but I don't think it needs to be part of the arrangement. What you are saying, Tim. It's a point of emphasis in terms of what SARS need to do in terms of making sure they've got the right capacity and capabilities to execute the administration of this law.
Okay. That's not correct, because now it's like we are insinuating that the wrong people are employed in SARS, and they're not comfortable with that at all. So I'm more comfortable with the definition that says, let's focus, let's separate these issues, you know, let's separate these issues.
Okay, that was the last
You thought of what, three?
Yeah, this is the third. Well, there were three additional ones after the first one. You said, I said I have three more after the first one. So there's four.
I accept that I can be very, very general in how I conduct my meeting. But don't also take advantage of that.
Yeah, you flagged the first one. You said, how many more do you have? I said three. This is now the third.
Yeah. No,
this is the third and final. Yeah. It's simply the question of the implementation date. And there's a very simple solution. Unless I'm reading this wrong, what SARS has done basically is committed to us that the regulations will provide for implementation on the 1st of April. But it isn't in the draft. So I have sympathy with the view that we need to give more time for those bodies to be formed and for the membership to be established. I think the 1st of April is not enough time. And all we do is risk making a whole lot of people illegal for no obvious reason. I think we should be more generous, and I think the appropriate place should be in the commencement section of the bill rather than in the regulations. And I think simply that means we should amend clause 67 to specify that I guess it will be clause 57, 58 come into effect on a late date, and I would suggest that date might be, say, the 1st of July 2013. We still maintain quite a tight deadline, but not as extremely tight as the 1st of April. So my proposal is that section clause 67 is amended to specify that clause 57 and 58, or even the specific required clauses within them, only come into effect on a later date, perhaps the 5th of July.
Why do you think the health of employer people will not be able to comply?
Because, as I said yesterday, Chair, in my question, I think January is a month where very little gets done, as you will know, in the economy. February is a month where everybody's looking and working on the budget. And then you have really 30 days in March to try and establish your body and sign up your members before you're suddenly illegal if you haven't by the 1st of April. I just think we need to give more time.
You know, my experience is if you want things to be done, to get done in South Africa, you must at all times try to make sure that your deadlines are both realistic, but they also try to push. And I can give a number of examples. Conversion of driver's license from your ID book to a card. I don't know how many deadlines were actually given. Precisely because people think there's always going to be an extension. Now, I would say, and I want to persuade committee members to accept this, should there be any specific issue that needs to be attended to beyond the 1st of April, SARS should be able to deal with that.
I think they asked for strange date, the 23rd of July. I don't know why. The staff asked for 1st of April. In the presentations, they've asked for 23rd of July, something like that. He's proposing 1st of July. I can't see any harm by pushing it out for 2 months. Rather than pushing it out in any event by 2 months, but then we must just make sure that they do have the powers to do that. I don't think they have. France can maybe assist us.
Thank you, Dave. Look, you would have two alternatives here if the committee is uncomfortable with the 1st of April. And you will recall that commentators were some split on what the date should be. They all had slightly different views on this one. You can either pick a date other than the 1st of April, which would be the 1st of July or the 1st of June, or whichever date you feel appropriate, or you could extend the discretion to the minister to specify a later date if it were necessary. I think the alternative would solve the problem that's been raised.
Why is your specific proposal?
We believe that the 1st of April is achievable, but the committee must make its own decision on that.
Well, I've got a presentation from the practitioner that says the 1st of July, that's all.
It's one.
And the second?
The other proposals were not as clear as that. They thought at some later date would be required, but no specific date was given, as I recall.
Leake? I think the view that you have pertaining to how the people of South Africa respond to timelines is very clear. To say, if you say 1st of July, you are just extending that just for the sake of extending. Otherwise, if the timeline, the commencement date is 1st of April, from now people will start to understand that something has to happen within a very short space of time. Otherwise, there will be no urgency in terms of people responding to the call. So I suggest that we use the 31st of April.
I think it's inappropriate for me to actually give an input on this because I was unfortunately not able to attend the meeting yesterday, but just my experience in terms of people coming to present your activity and making a specific proposal, this will be more feasible in a specific recommendation in a date or later period, which is only 3 months. It shows that those people have, which is a consultation process, but we need to look very seriously at the recommendations. And then Honourable Harris, what he's done is to refine, and if you look at all his proposals, and I was not present, but he's trying to refine some of the amendments
to get more clarity, and I think it would be to a certain extent in my mind, and I must differ unfortunately with presentations that would like to restrict us to a date which is not cast in stone, but the recommendation from the consultation process is the 1st of July. Why not do it if it could be easier, if it could enhance the process, if we can solve the problems? And it's not that we try to derail the implementation. It was a consultation process that we need to give our hearing to. Thank you.
Yeah. Thomas, last time. And I'm going to make a ruling.
I can't say more than I have already. As we've said, 1st of April is tight, but we believe achievable. But if the committee feels that as a result of the consultation process you would like to give people an extra 2 months, 3 months, that is the committee's decision.
Well, what it says is that you are not going to wait until the 1st of April in order to meet the target of July. You just actually make it more flexible in terms of making sure that people have up to the 1st of July as a final date. There is no way we're actually saying the implementation should not actually take place between now and the 1st of July, if one has put it that way. Therefore, let's accommodate each other and one another along those lines. 1st of July. Agreed? All right. Tim?
I mean, what we're effectively agreeing is that the regulations will say that. Correct, because we're not legislating this. This is simply a commitment that SIZOS makes to what they will put into the regulations, unless I'm missing something.
Okay, if you have a look at the amendment proposed to Section 240, the date of 1st of April is specified there. So what has been proposed is a change in the legislation.
All right. Nyambo? If that's the case, Chair, I'll propose that. Why don't you then wave to the minister? Leave to the minister. In terms of, other than chair, because some of these dates are thumbs up. We were not given reason that day when they said it's either the 1st of July or the late October. So why don't we follow the act that if we can agree on the 1st of April, let the minister deal with that. I think we're leaving it more open-ended now. With that. I think the Treasury says 1st of April is achievable. The practitioner says, in terms of their presentation, we want to comply. Let the closing date, if one has to use that, be the 1st of July rather than the 1st of April.
Thank you, Chair. I just noticed a little confusion on the other side of the room. The original wording of 240 did not have a date in it. That was inserted as a result of the public consultation because it would have automatically then have come into force on the date of promulgation. Okay, so the 1st of April was then inserted for the bill as introduced, and we would then obviously need to change that if a different date is specified.
Yeah. Okay. 1st of July. All right. The last one is the one that we skipped, Tim, and it's around May or March. If it's a May, Tim, May or March will cause an earthquake.
I'd like to understand how big an earthquake it would be. Can I request, Chair, that you ask your state law advisor to give this opinion?
On what? On the May or March?
Parliamentary law advisor, on whether we should amend it to be March.
Is it March now? And you say you propose in May.
Well, the existing tax law says May, and the amendment says must. I'm suggesting that we don't amend it. Therefore, May.
We stick to the existing.
Yeah.
May. Tomasek?
As I say, what that does do is introduce certain system challenges for us because we now have to treat the 120,000-odd people who find themselves in this situation as exceptions across the board. And so you're dealing with the subset of the 120,000 who are outside the 20% margin for error. So you're going to have to make a fairly significant change to ensure that essentially what happens is the opportunity for giving reasons as to why you are outside 20% margin of error are not given after the penalty is imposed but before the penalty is imposed. That is really the crux of the matter. It is not a question of whether a penalty should be imposed or not. It is the timing of giving your reasons why you missed your margin of error. That is the crux of the matter here.
Kev? I mean, I think what Franz is trying to say is, look, it's a presumption. You apply it in the first instance and then you pull out. There's always a may element in it. The key thing here that's bothering me is that we're talking about equity here. The smaller guys are already under the must regime. Now the big guys suddenly get the benefit of the may regime because the big accounting firms, the big law firms are here lobbying. Now it seems to me that the guys who are the bigger players have the big guns behind them. They should be following these things a lot more closely than the little guys. So it seems to me unfair to put the bigger guys under a lighter load than the little guys. So as a matter of equity, I think it should remain a must. And again, I think what's being said is this is a presumption. So your first penalty is imposed, and then you then request for relief. And again, if you're one of the bigger guys, you've got the army of attorneys and accountants, they'll do that for you. So I really don't think this is, you know, I mean, I would stick to the amendment as is. I mean, my suggestion, but I'm assisting here.
Advocate? Chairperson, thank you for that. I agree with the analysis, the effect of how it is and how we're trying to change it with the amendments, bring everybody under the same umbrella. And I would just add why I would agree, and that's the principles of public administration and constitution require public officials to be developmental orientated. And I would think that that's a step in the right direction. It is still a presumption that can be overturned if one has a good reason for it. I would agree with National Treasury. Thank you, Chair.
Tim?
I'll concede this one, Chair.
You have considered all three. Thank you. Tawarek?
If I may, that does mean we now need to do a people for this.
No.
Not.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And I would just like to flag one issue then. There are a couple of typographical errors in the bill that stands now that managed to escape our proofreading, and we would fairly like to fix those too as part of the people process.
Okay, honourable members, I think we have come to an end. Let me make it formal so that I can append my signature. The Standing Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill B35/2012, National Assembly Section 75, referred to it and classified by the JTM as Section 75 Bill Report, the bill with amendments. Agreed? Thank you. You are relieved. The meeting stands, the meeting is again. Thank you.